Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 1st of October, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. We're having all kinds of technical difficulties today. Patrick, welcome back to the programme, Patrick.
Oh, it's great to be here, Mike.
We're going to be joined in a second by Dr. Graham Downing. It's been a busy few weeks for you, and you're back in the swing of things. We did a Sunday Wire last night, and 21st Century Wire back in full swing again.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a great show last night. Thank you for joining us. We had two fantastic guests, Vanessa Beale and Eva Bartlett. I encourage people to go to 21stCenturyWire.com and check out episode 250. It was great. Thank you.
Okay, right. Well, let's get straight on with it then. And, I published an article last week on the UK Column News, on the UK Column website, Patrick. UK corporate media, social media platforms must pay. And this is really all about the ongoing discussion over how corporate media is going to be paid for in the future, because advertising revenues have collapsed to such a degree that they can no longer fund the staffs that they've been used to. They've relieved themselves of their best journalists and replaced them with young 20-somethings straight out of university that really know nothing about anything. But this was a little bit of it here. Paywalls and memberships are the two main non-advertising-based revenue models being used right now. Others are being discussed. And one of the ones that's being discussed, I say, or how about NGOs and campaign groups funding investigative journalism? The possibility of Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth paying for content to be produced is being considered. Well, this is something that's being discussed on various discussion programs on the BBC that are media related. I think the Media Show is one of them. They've discussed this conversation, but Dr. Graham Downing pointed me at this article. Now, I think it's about a year old now. It's in The Guardian, and its headline is "Vaccination in Adults: A Change in Attitude Could Help Prevent Serious Disease." So, Graham, if I say welcome to the programme, the key thing you wanted to highlight on this was this, the fact that this is paid for by GlaxoSmithKline.
Yeah, absolutely. So how about that? So, you know, we can have an opinion on something, we can pay a British journal, and then they'll stick it on their front page or somewhere. I mean, this is outrageous. It's, you know, what's happened to journalism in this country. And also, you know, what they should have, if they're going to do that, then surely they should have someone on the other side giving the other point of view. And, you know, this is, you know, is anybody left that actually really trusts the British media anymore, other than independent media? More and more people I know just switch them off.
Look, I just wanted to make this point, Graham, because, you know, in fairness to The Guardian, it does say at the top in small print that almost nobody's going to pay any attention to, that it is paid content. And as we've pointed out, they do put the GSK logo on there. Now, I just wanted to explain a little bit about what The Guardian says about this. They have a page on this, and it says content funding on The Guardian. And what they're saying is Guardian News and Media produces a variety of content with funding from outside parties. These sources of revenue allow us to explore topics that we hope are of interest to Guardian and Observer readers. The presentation of the content makes clear how the content has been commissioned and produced and who has funded it. One of three labels will appear in this content, supported by, paid content, or paid for by, or advertiser content, or from our advertisers. So I wanted to look at the first one of those, which is supported content. And they say it's used to describe editorially independent content. We accept funding from third parties, both for new projects and for content we're already producing. Before funding is agreed with a client, relevant senior editors are consulted about suitability, and the editor-in-chief has the final say in whether a funding deal is accepted. A client whose branding appears on editorial content may have a role in suggesting what kind of topics are covered, but commissioning editors are not obliged to accept ideas from the funder. The content is written and edited by Guardian and Observer journalists or those approved by GNM, that's the Guardian Media Group, and to the same standards expected of all our journalists. So that's what they're saying. And they make the point that in the case of supported by, they say supported by is also used to describe editorially independent content that The Guardian has produced with funding from foundations around the world who support specific projects. Examples of foundation funding include a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to help support the Guardian's global development site, a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to support the Guardian Cities project, a grant from the Skoll Foundation to support Guardian climate and environment reporting. Now, that is supported by content, but the content that we've just shown was paid for content. And what the Guardian says there is that in that case, paid for content is written not by Guardian journalists, but by commercial corporate interest. So surely, Graham, the first question here is whether or not this is ethical from a journalistic standpoint.
Well, I mean, that's okay, Mike, isn't it? Because if it's not blatantly paid for, we've got the independent Bill Gates there funding it as well. So we haven't got anything to worry about there, have we?
We don't have anything to worry there, do we?
Not at all. What is this, Mike? Is this? It seems to me that the Guardian's renting out their platform. Is that probably a more accurate description of what's going on? Renting out their platform to the highest bidder. It doesn't matter if they're a charity or a foundation. All of these organizations have political agendas, and in fact, I'm going to have to say this, Mike. It's a bit of a circular problem here. All of the foundations also get corporate funding as well. So I mean, what is this? It's just dressing up.
They become prostitutes, basically. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a bit extreme. I would use the term corporate mattress back myself, but that's okay. Yeah.
Okay, well, look, Graham, let's just briefly, because we've done this before, but let's just briefly remind ourselves of what we are told about vaccines, and you have chosen the flu vaccine here as an example. So first of all, what we're told by Public Health England is that this is, in fact, not only good for women, but for pregnant women, but essential for pregnant women. But on the right-hand side there, we have the reality, which you've just taken one example of a scientific paper showing that there is toxicity for the fetus.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the last thing that, you know, look, I always say to people, you know, speak to your healthcare provider, you know, have a balanced view on this. But I think there's enough evidence now to as exemplified in that study, when they had people were having a serial flu vaccine on top of another flu vaccine, and the synergistic toxicity of that increased the death of the fetus. There's other issues as well. When they give these vaccines, they cause the immune system to rev up. And when you rev up the immune system around a developing fetus, you increase certain things such as IL-17, IL-17A, IL-6. And these things have been demonstrated now can go into the brain of developing fetus, and they can, in fact, cause that brain not to develop properly. This is pretty serious stuff. So, you know, with the greatest respect to these people, I wouldn't feel good saying to someone having a flu vaccine, certainly not if they're pregnant.
And something else that we've highlighted in the past as well is that the difference between the death statistics with regard to the flu and the flu vaccine.
Yeah, what they do every year is they push up this enormous number of deaths, and they did it in this article as well. Well, they tried, did it a different way now, because we've kind of called them out on it. They say, 30,000 people are dying every year. You've got to get your flu jab. And you can see from there, you've got HPA flu deaths there, which have been pushed out. And a classic example would be 2008. It quotes over 10,000 people who have died from the flu. And if you look at the Office of National Statistics on the right, you saw, in fact, there's only 39 people that died from the flu. So what they're doing now is they're bringing the number down, saying, but it's probably more, because they've been called out on this. And, you know, these independent bodies, whether it's allegedly a journalist or a government organization, should be independent. They shouldn't be propaganda arms for drug companies. We do need drugs. People have arguments on both sides of the fence to do with vaccines, and we can flesh that out if you want. But what we need is in the middle, we need an honest referee. And unfortunately, we do not have an honest referee.
And just to end this segment, Graham, you pointed out to me recently that, I mean, we've been talking about the issue of censorship on social media quite a lot in the last several weeks and months, because it's becoming an increasing issue. It seems that people that are talking about vaccinations are not experiencing any better situations. So we have We have a graphic here, a message sent by Pinterest, which is a social media platform that allows people to pin images that they see on the internet as being of interest to them and put them in sort of on boards on Pinterest. And they have written here to somebody who had a board, a Pinterest board called Vaccine Information, and they're saying, we're reaching out to let you know we have removed your vaccine information board because it went against our policies on self-harm. We think it's important to keep Pinterest a positive place for everyone, so we don't allow content that idealizes or advocates self-harm, suicide, or eating disorders. Please consider these policies as you pin going forward. If you're struggling with self-harm of any type, please know there is help. For treatment referrals, information, and support, check out the resources on our help centre. So, Graham, is anybody discussing vaccination as an issue, the pros and the cons, is that they're harming themselves in having that conversation, are they?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to flesh more detail out on this, there's a couple of articles. One on EuropeReloaded.com. Go straight to that. There's an article there on it. And that's posted across on the LibertyBeacon.com as well. There's a very good article there on it. This is absolutely disgraceful. And this is a very, very dangerous trend here, is that you're not just seeing it there, you're seeing it across the board. What they're doing is, if you dare to put anything up, lots of people got those notices from Pinterest. Basically, they were just putting up one woman whose mum had died after a flu jab, other women who had children that were harmed were posting information, and their boards were deleted, and they inquired about that or complained about that, and that's the notice they got back, saying effectively you're mentally unwell, and if you need help, this is where you need to go. Now, this is a very, very dangerous trend, and as I said, there's those articles, you can check that out. And to give you just hot off the press, there's a committee called the JCVI, Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. And they effectively decide what vaccinations you are going to get, because they're going to bring mandatory vaccinations in down the line for adults as well, unless they're stopped, and what vaccinations kids have got to have. And once again, they're going to try and bring mandatory vaccinations down the line. They're pushing for that. A vaccine called Bexsero for meningitis was put to this board, and they rejected it. It was then put to a later board, and it was accepted. And then we find out that the chair of that board had a hand in developing that vaccine. And you see this over and over and over and over again. And as I said, I'm not going to tell you to vaccinate or not, but what I am going to demand is that we have a fair level playing field. And this kind of nonsense, this kind of backhanding deals that look like are going on, need to stop.
At the end of the day, then, what we've got is the likes of GlaxoSmithKline getting free rein to pay for what are effectively advertorials in The Guardian. Meanwhile, that being a closed shop, as it's in a sense, meanwhile, anybody trying to put their own information up on their own social media channels are having those shut down. It is an interesting world we live in.
I don't have any problem per se with that. Let me just interject real quickly before we get the last word from Graham. But, you know, if The Guardian would run pieces critical of corporate products and vaccinations and pharmaceutical companies, of which there's plenty of material to take that editorial line, if they would do that and have some equal time there, I don't see that's not such a bad idea, I think. But they're not even making any attempt to go in that direction. In fact, quite the opposite, because money talks. And when Big Pharma's got money to lay down on the table for The Guardian, there is a quid pro quo. And that silent quid pro quo is probably, you are not going to slate our products or our industry, thank you very much, or this money is not going into The Guardian's coffers. I think it's pretty simple, that equation.
Graham, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that if you go across to those websites, as I said, EuropeReloaded.com and the LibertyBeacon.com, there's an excellent article on it there. What the worrying thing is you're seeing serious researchers now in the same sentence talk about mental illness and anti-vaxxers. And most people I know have come up and spoke to me aren't anti-vaxxers. They're people that just want the truth. They just want to know what's really going on with this research, and they want honest research. Mm-hmm. And this is this is starting to look like, the gulag. You know, let's not dismiss that as extreme, because if you disagreed, if you were not agreeing with whatever the government suggested you should agree with, then you were hauled off under some kind of psychiatric mental illness diagnosis. and you're seeing this being floated out now and mentioned. And in fact, these people have had notices saying, because you've posted this this material that questions safety, and quite rightly so, we're now going to consider that you may have a mental illness. This is absolutely and utterly disgraceful.
Okay, Dr. Grim Downing, thank you very much for joining us. That's been very useful, and we'll have you back on in the not-too-distant future, I hope.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm back on with Ian on Thursday. We're going to really flesh this out on Thursday on humanity versus insanity. Thank you.
Okay, super. Thanks, Graham. Okay, Patrick, let's move on then. And, well, quick advertisement for Media on Trial, Part 4, The Russian Connection. So we've got Andrei Nekrasov speaking. And in fact, you'll be interviewing him at that event. This is on October the 28th. Sunday, October the 28th, begins at 2 p.m. It's in the Black E and Great George Street in Liverpool. Vanessa Bailey will also be speaking, as will Piers Robinson, Tim Hayward and Robert Stewart, so the usual suspects there. But this is pretty exciting to have Andrei Nekrasov there.
It is. And his film, if you haven't had a chance, I think it's made appearances up online, The Magnitsky Act. It has appeared and it's been pulled down in some cases, but I think it's been successfully uploaded to YouTube.
Pat, I would encourage people, because it's only £3 or something to rent it officially.
Yep.
And I would just say, you know, people like Andrei need financial help. So rather than watching it on YouTube, if you could get on and actually rent it through the properly, then that would be be great.
Can it be rented on what platforms can people watch it on?
If you go and look at the website, his website, you'll find it very quickly.
Mm. So it's going to be very interesting. Like, of course, this is a very complex story, the story of Bill Browder. I think Andrei's uncovered a line on this story that nobody else has to date. And done so with incredible detail in his investigation. So we are looking forward to learning more about this story at this event.
Okay, now, good news, Patrick, because the government has decided to build the Hitler Youth. We've talked about this in other ways in the past, but it continues to grow. So this is the Cadets Cyber First program. It's being delivered by the Ministry of Defence, Cadet Organisations and GCHQ National Cybersecurity Centre. They say they're going to equip over 2,000 cadets a year with the skills and expertise to become future leaders in this emerging industry of cybersecurity. And this 2,000 is part of their plans to increase the number of cadets in school units to 60,000 by 2024. And this is they're going to celebrate their achievements through National Cadet Week. It's fantastic. So lots of money being put into this. And cadets will be able to choose from introductory courses covering the tools, knowledge and skills to protect small networks, and more advanced courses where they'll be fully immersed in cybersecurity issues. This is with a view to developing new talent to join GCHQ as soon as they're old enough to do so. Fantastic. So this is part, as I say, of GCHQ's Cyber First initiative. What do you think of that?
Well, cadet, isn't that a military, isn't that a term normally used for the military, cadet?
It's like, well, it is. This is exactly what it is.
Junior soldier,
yes.
Or
exactly.
Soldier in training.
Yes.
So it's really the militarization of civilian life. That's how I read this. The numbers you're talking about, Mike, there, 60,000
a year.
It's a little bit over the top, and one would have to ask the question: how many of these cadets are going to be doing JTRIG type work? And if you're not familiar with JTRIG, you might look up JTRIG, GCHQ, all sorts of nefarious practices. Some of these were leaked in some of the Snowden leaks. Where they're training people how to create fake accounts, how to attack people, all sorts of online subterfuge to attack dissenting political views and so forth, or alternative media outlets online. So with 60,000 a year of this these cadets, Mike, it's a little bit worrying. Mm. These numbers will be approaching Chinese levels after not very long, Mike, and I have to remind us that China has 1 billion-some-odd people in their country. Mm. We only have 15 million here. So what exactly will they be doing? I think this is an offensive program myself. It's not a defensive program. It's an offensive program. otherwise you wouldn't need so many people.
Absolutely. Now, so Cyber First is what it's called. Here's what wonderful Gavin Williamson had to say. He said, cyber threats in the UK are constantly evolving, and this exciting initiative to train and develop cyber cadets, the first of its kind in a NATO state, reaffirms our leading role in tackling threats, security threats head on. So that's good stuff. Now, this was the first of quite a number of statements that Gavin was making over the weekend. The next is even better news, Patrick, because apparently we now have our first two F-35s on the HMS Queen Elizabeth. There we go.
Okay.
Two of them. It's really superb. So they've landed on the deck of the new aircraft carrier, making history and marking the beginning of more than half a century of carrier strike operations. This is Royal Navy Commander Nathan Gray and RAF Squadron Leader Andy Edgell, who flew their planes onto the deck and off again. And apparently they're going to do that 500 more times, so that's exciting for them. And this is the return of carrier strike to the UK, which comes 8 years after a fighter jet last landed on a British carrier. And apparently HMS Queen Elizabeth class carriers will be able to project British military power across the globe for the next half century. They can also provide humanitarian relief, deepen defence relationships with key allies, and provide critical support to our forces as they're deployed across the world. So I'm really impressed with this whole operation. Apparently we're going to have something like 36 in total able to be carried on this aircraft carrier. But of course, they won't be British. They'll be American at the beginning for some time.
Okay.
Because we don't have enough of them.
So American pilots and American planes, right?
To start with, aside from these two. But in the meantime, Gavin Williamson was saying something about this as well. So this is really good stuff. This historic first landing on the deck of HMS Queen Elizabeth is a monumental moment in our country's proud military history. I'm feeling the pride running through me in ways that I can't possibly describe.
Absolutely. It puts the Battle of Britain to shame, Mike. It puts World War II to shame.
To
see those two F-35s there in all of their glory, I hope they work. And I hope that the oxygen systems are working at a certain altitude, and that's not going to be a problem for the pilots. So we've got our fingers crossed. But I have to say, Mike, there's a lot of critics. If you read some of the forums on the defense forums, top speed for the F-35, I might be mistaken, Mach 1.4. Is that sound about right?
No, that sounds a bit low. But
it's a bit low. Okay.
But maybe that's all it's capable of at the moment.
I'm not sure, because it's a heavy plane. Maybe, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe it's Mach 2 or Mach 3. I'm not sure. Top speed of the S-400 missile defense system that Russia's rolling out is something like, is it Mach 14? Something like that. 10 times the speed of sound.
Well.
So basically, there's people saying in these forums that the new missile defense systems, hypersonic missile defense systems, are going to make these fighter jets redundant, some of them, in terms of a combat situation. So, there's definitely a debate going on there.
So what you're suggesting is that this is merely a bung to the military-industrial complex and the manufacturer?
Oh, I think it's exactly what Gavin Williams said. It's projecting power. Whether that's actual real power in terms of a military situation is really down to the combat situation. So there is a lot of this power projection. All countries do it. China, Russia, the United States, Britain included.
Well, it gets better because apparently we have now developed a defense Arctic strategy. So this is fantastic for the first time. Gavin Williamson again over the weekend announced a new defense Arctic strategy, acknowledging the increasing opportunities and threats that the region presents. So the strategy will enhance the MOD's focus on the Arctic, underlined by our current commitments in the region and future deployments. So this is really exciting stuff. What did our Minister for War say about this? He said, Russia, with more submarines operating under the ice and ambitions to build over 100 facilities in the Arctic, are staking a claim and militarizing the region, and therefore we've got to go and sort them out. Apparently this is going to complement NATO's commitments in the Arctic. And in 2019, four RAF Typhoons will, for the first time, patrol Icelandic skies. And this is going to allow the UK to work closely with allies to deter aerial threats to the Euro-Atlantic security. So I'm feeling safer already. I asked you this question earlier. I'll ask it again. Is Russia militarizing the region?
Well, that's down to how you're perceiving the issue, Mike. If you look at the map, which I hope Gavin Williamson has done recently, Russia actually has quite a long coastline which borders the Arctic. So in terms of that, yeah, those are their borders, Mike. So any activity that Russia's doing there in terms of fuel exploration or energy, downline energy development, that's definitely in their national interest. And I would say the same would go for Canada as well, and Greenland if they had such an industry. But I suppose if Canada is doing that sort of exploration, it's okay, because after all, Canada is a NATO country. But if Russia is doing any of that, well, that's just the militarization of the Arctic. So I think...
So if Gavin's going to send British military forces, which don't exist, into the Arctic to deal with Russia there, the United States intends to blockade Russia in the Black Sea, is this?
Well, not quite to the Arctic. It sounds like they're going to dispatch four typhoons to patrol Icelandic airspace, not quite the Arctic. So maybe there's just not enough fuel to get those typhoons to the Arctic, or maybe Britain doesn't have the refueling air-to-air refueling capability to go too far, to venture too far off the reservation. So just keeping it safe, Icelandic airspace for now. But who knows, Mike, one day they may be able to control the airspace over the Arctic. Just give it time.
But as I say, the United States then, they're going to run a blockade in the Black Sea.
Well, this is our Secretary of the Interior here in the Trump cabinet, another one of the brain trust, Ryan Zinke, has threatening a naval blockade, and really it's quite an extraordinary quote. He's basically saying that, you know, the United States has to export its energy to the world, and it has the capability to block Russia from delivering its fuel products around the world. It's quite a dangerous statement to make, Mike, quite naive, but then totally in character for the Trump cabinet. These are people that are usually short on any sort of geopolitical perspective, long on rhetoric and bluster. I just want to remind people, but these very games that he's describing here are one of the main reasons that drew Japan into the Second World War to attack the United States. More specifically at Pearl Harbor. Go up and look that up in your history books yourself. Japan just didn't attack for no reason. They were under an embargo by the United States that had to do with fuel that it needed to import. So this is a very dangerous game that the U.S. would be playing if it was doing such a thing. But then again, maybe we can just chalk this down to another completely crazy member of the Trump cabinet, a neoconservative, that doesn't quite know what he's talking about. Still, it's dangerous rhetoric, Mike.
Okay, let's move over to Syria then. And Sputnik here reporting EU states ready to finance disarming of militants in Syria, according to the UN chief's aide. Really?
Yes, really. So it's only fitting, Mike, because they paid to arm the terrorists in Syria. So now they're offering to pay to disarm the terrorists. I've got a much better idea, however. I'd like to suggest that the EU states, anybody, or the United States for that matter, or the Gulf states, anybody involved in arming any of these terrorist groups, supplying them, offering any material support whatsoever, should now pay reparations to Syria for, because they've effectively lost the war. And isn't that the rules in warfare, Mike? Yeah. The loser pays reparations. Well, these EU countries are losers in this proxy war of the last 7 years, as is the United States, as is Canada, all the NATO member states. Turkey as well is effectively, well, it soon will be, but it's still occupying part of Syria. The United States is still occupying part of Syria. But let's just put the EU countries there. Yes, they're losers, as are the Gulf states as well, the people who have basically plowed billions of dollars into trying to destroy this nation state in the Middle East, and they've lost, so they should pay reparations, not just pay to disarm the jihadis. There's a lot more economic ways of achieving that result, I can tell you right now.
Interesting idea. Well, on Friday at the UN, after the UN General Assembly, Sergei Lavrov was talking a little bit about the Syrian situation. And he was saying that he was concerned that there were some moves to take some of these jihadis out of Syria and send them to Afghanistan. He said there is talk that they'll be sent off to other hotspots, for example, Afghanistan. This is unacceptable. They have to be eliminated, or there has to be a judicial process. He said that Turkey faces a task which isn't simple in Idlib. He said that the United States had also promised to persuade moderate fighters to split from jihadist groups, but seems to have failed to deliver on that one. Of course, they have. He also said that Russia would be delivering the S-300 air defense systems to Syria, that those deliveries have now begun, and that he's taken this measure in order to ensure 100% safety of Russian servicemen in Syria. So before we move on with this, Patrick, this is sending a pretty strong message to Israel.
This is. I don't know if I'm sure you did cover that story, Mike, while I was away, but the air incident, which involved the Russian navigation plane that was caught in a three-way crossfire, and Israel, well, Russia laid the responsibility at the feet of Israel for that incident. So that did, in a way, give Mike Russia license to expedite the S-300 and S-400 orders that have been talked about for so long, but that Israel has been vehemently opposing for various reasons. Well, the obvious reason is it won't give Israel carte blanche to fly wherever it wants over Syrian airspace and bomb any targets that it sees fit to make up some spurious excuse that it's attacking a Hezbollah weapons facility or some Iranian base. These are sort of the usual excuses made by Israel. So Russia has the license, Mike, and that's a game changer because the United States, who is really leading this proxy war, and, well, it's not all proxy. They're occupying a third of the country, but they've relied on Israel as the kind of it's meant to look like an independent third party, but Israel is doing strategic strikes, hitting Syrian army capabilities, not Iranian capabilities, and weakening or probing the Syrian anti-aircraft defense perimeter around the country. This is what Israel has been doing for the last 6 years, Mike. It's been doing so with complete coordination with the United States. If anybody doesn't think that that's not totally coordinated with America, that's incredibly naive, especially considering the United States opened a military base, a full-fledged military installation in Israel in the summer of 2017. Was anybody paying attention when that happened? Mm. It's located not very far, I believe, might be mistaken, from Dimona, in that sort of general vicinity in the desert there. So it's interesting. It's also very risky, Mike. It's very risky because this effectively puts Israel into a corner and almost forces its hand to maybe do something rash, to reassert itself and to regain some of its lost position, Mike. So it's very dangerous.
It's interesting that somebody just mentioning F-35s again in the chat box, but it's interesting that Israel has already flown F-35s on missions into Syria. It's the first time the F-35 has been deployed in anger, as it were. It'd be very interesting to see and just what happens should they try that again under these circumstances. But let's move on then with Lavrov, because he then went on to talk about the potential for further provocations from the White Helmets and others. He said that the White Helmets had staged fake chemical weapons attacks in Syria aimed at provoking war. He said some of our Western colleagues who want to assign blame are content to rely on assertions in the vein of the notorious highly likely. We've already been through this. We remember well how many times false pretexts were used to justify interventions in wars, like in Yugoslavia in 1999, Iraq in 2003, and Libya in 2011. So he's not pulling any punches there. And then he went on to talk about Ukraine. And he was saying now the same methods are being used. He went on to say that now the same methods are being used against Syria, and that would be unacceptable. He said that this year is the 80th anniversary of the Munich conspiracy that crowned the criminal appeasement of the Third Reich. And serves as a sad example of the disastrous consequences that can result from national egotism, disregard for international law and seeking solutions at the expense of others. Regrettably today, in many countries, the anti-Nazi vaccine is not only weakened, there's a growing campaign to rewrite history and whitewash war criminals and their accomplices. The growth of radical nationalism and neo-Nazism in Ukraine, where criminals who fought under SS banners are glorified as heroes, is one of the main factors of the protracted domestic conflict in Ukraine. So I find it hard to criticize what he's saying, and he's really hitting the nail on the head there. But we're not going to see any of that kind of commentary in the Western press.
No, no. No, I don't think so. I think the sad thing about Americans, and I'm going to say it's also a sad thing that's emerging in Western Europe, is people are whitewashing history and are forgetting. And I think they go a long way in the West to downplay the fact that the Third Reich, Mike, was effectively defeated not by the Americans and the Allied forces. It was brought to its knees, and half of it was wiped by the Russians, by the Soviet Union. But also the Soviet Union incurred losses of orders of magnitude in terms of loss of life from what the Western Allied powers did, and we're talking plus 20 million, Mike. So, you know, the country's not going to forget that very easily. And here we have the U.S. government backing effectively a coup in February of 2014 in the Ukraine, and really activating neo-Nazi groups, John McCain sharing a stage with these very far-right groups who are glorifying Nazi heroes in World War II. This is the side the United States has taken. That is Barack Obama's government that went into a partnership with these groups in order, because in their eyes in Washington, the ends justifies the means. So Russia finds this abhorrent. I think any sane person would probably agree with Russia on this. But then that means we have to ask, are there any sane people in Washington or in their NATO partner states as well? Will the sane people please stand up and make yourself known?
Okay, let's end on this one then, Patrick, because, Nick Clegg is back on the scene in the UK, and here we are. Can you believe this guy, is the comment from Abe Warden, the slithering snake who wiped out the Lib Dems and elevated deception in UK politics to a new height, now has wet dreams of becoming a prime minister. Seriously, he thinks we're that stupid. And so what's he referring to? Well, Cleggy put this out. Well, as deputy prime minister, I blocked the mad Tory ideas for a referendum on Brexit, of course. As prime minister, I guess I could just stop their mad ideas for Brexit altogether. Well, where are we ending with this? Are we going to see Cleggy making a Tony Blair-style resurgence?
Is it just me? Well, the previous tweeter pointed this out. If it wasn't for Nick Clegg, the Tories probably wouldn't be in power, Mike. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, they wouldn't have been in power in 2010, that's for sure. And that's when most of the damage was done.
Interesting that he would. He reminds me a lot of Tony Blair in that sense. Just sort of like emerging from the
swamp,
the netherworld of the political basement, and coming in to try to claim relevancy once again, very much like Blair, but not on the scale of Blair, of course, not on the grandeur of Tony, but very interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back at the usual time, 1 p.m. on Wednesday, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.